I'm Leonard Lopate, and this is WNYC 93.9 AM 820. We're online at WNYC.org. Artha Gelb has been having a passionate love affair for nearly 60 years, and the woman in question is the Gray Lady of Times Square. He started working at the New York Times in 1944 as a night copy boy, the lowest position on the staff. By the time he retired in 1990, he had become the paper's managing editor. Mr. Gelb fondly recalls the events that shook the world and shaped the paper of record during those years in his memoir, City Room. The book is from Putnam, and I'm very pleased that it has brought Artha Gelb to the show today. Hello. Good to see you again.
Thanks for inviting me.
Is your devotion to the New York Times unique, or do most of its employees feel the same way?
I think most of them, in my era, I can speak for that era, of course, very competently, most of them did feel the same way. I think when I started there in 1944, my colleagues, I truthfully believe, would have worked on the Times for lunch money and car fare, and they just money didn't mean very much then. But the passion was to work for a newspaper.
In fact, you quote Grover Cleveland Loud, who was a copy editor at the Times, as saying people work at newspapers for the fun of it. But I have been told by people who applied for jobs at the Times that the way to get a job there is to say, whether you believe this or not, to say to the person interviewing you, it's always been my dream to work for the New York Times. The Times wants to hear that.
I think as an editor, I wanted to hear it. I wanted people to come to the Times who would love the Times the way I love the Times. Whether I believed all of them is a question. I did believe some of them. There are people who are there today who would go nowhere else but the New York Times. People have some very, very talented people have started their lives at the Times and ended their careers at the Times.
And you say that the pay was lousy. I hope it's better these days,
it's
now
much,
that the Times is one of the most important papers in the world. But then, was it a struggling paper financially?
It was a family-owned paper. Not started by Edo Fox, but he bought the paper when it was going into bankruptcy in 1896. And he had this vision of what a great newspaper should be. He also, because he had this vision and wanted the vision to work, he put the profits back into the paper. He kept, when there was a problem, instead of, as we like to say at the Times, instead of watering the soup, he added potatoes and meat to the soup. He always improved the paper by putting the profits back.
But in those days, the Times had a lot of competition, a lot more than
tremendous
it does now. And it had the Herald Tribune, which was also a great newspaper.
Great newspaper. And our main competition. And I believe that the New York Times survived because it stuck to those Adolf Essox principles of thoroughness, impartiality, accuracy, fair taste. Not always work. It doesn't always work. There are plenty of mistakes that are made. We're working under pressure all the time. Those principles kept the paper alive. I think the poorest papers that don't stick to those principles will disappear.
Although there have been moments when the Times has been accused of not being impartial. Maybe we'll get to some of those as we go on. What makes working at a newspaper fun? Is it kind of like joining the armed services? Do you forge really strong bonds and allegiances with your colleagues because of the daily pressures?
The daily pressure has a lot to do with it, and also the idea that we are putting out every single day, every day of the year, a new product. You start in the morning, the assignments are out, the reporters come back, they work under deadline pressure. It's very exciting to work under deadline pressure, knowing that they're going to see their own stories with their own bylines just a few hours later in the paper. And they start the process all over again the next day. There's very few businesses that have anything close to that.
Was it as difficult to get a job at the Times in 1944 as I imagine it is today?
In 1944, it wasn't as difficult. First of all, the war was on, and many of the reporters had been drafted. So
not necessarily as journalists either.
No, very few as journalists. A lot of them were in the infantry, and a lot of them were killed. But it still was difficult. And my first job was copy boy, which, as you said before, was the lowest rung of the ladder.
How much did you get paid in 1944?
$16 a week. It was enough to, you know, just let me survive, but I don't think any of us cared about what we got paid. We lived in rooms in Greenwich Village. We stayed up all night in the newspaper saloons. The camaraderie was amazing. We were all very close in discussing the day's stories, how we got them. If a reporter made a mistake in those days, he feared going into the saloons because he knew he would be an object of derision. And so we were our own critics.
How close was the atmosphere and the environment to the movies that we know about from that time, Front Page and His Girl Friday?
Quite close. I thought when I knew I was ready to go to work as a newspaper man, I dropped out of college, City College. I later went back because my mother was very upset, and she said, "You must get your degree." And I went back for my mother's sake.
You were from an immigrant family, and immigrant families, yes, definitely wanted college graduates.
Every parent I knew in the Bronx where I lived wanted their children to go to college. So I thought the Times was kind of a stodgy. I respected it, but I thought it was a stodgy newspaper. The paper that I wanted to go to work for, that I read every day religiously, I also read the Times, was PM. It was a paper that was founded by Ralph Ingersoll, who had this idea of a newspaper that would never be obligated to advertisers in any way, so there was no advertising in the paper. It was bankrolled by Marshall Field III, who was a very liberal department store magnate in Chicago. He also bankrolled the Chicago Sun. And that's where I wanted to go to work. There was no opening there, but the woman who interviewed me said, "Why don't you hurry over to the Times? I know there's an opening for a copy boy."
Well, it was considered a rather leftist newspaper. Later, it became the Compass, didn't it?
Later, it moved more and more to the left. But in the days I'm talking about, it was just a liberal paper, not on the left, but a strongly motivated paper to look for wrongdoing. When I walked into that newsroom, called it a city room, then it was later rechristened the newsroom, I couldn't believe it because I thought, you know, I had this idea of the stodgy paper. Well, the room being in such constant motion, the noise, the clutter, the reporters are typing their stories, copy boys responding to the yell of copy, moving the copy to the copy desk, where editors using paste and scissors were revising the stories. As soon as I saw it, I realized my heart started thumping, and I realized this is where I wanted to spend the rest of my life.
How soon before you realized that some of the copy boys were also running bookie operations?
Yes, I found that out very quickly. The managing editor was a very famous man. You know, he did this great story, which I had read in high school, of Lindbergh's arrival in Paris, and the story was magnificent. In fact, I had memorized, as I said in City Room, I memorized many passages of that story. And here was, I found him in the City Room the day I arrived. He was very flashily dressed. He wore spats. He had a stick pin in his tie. He had a very colorful vest. And then I discovered, when he came out of his office, he would head toward a corner desk. At this corner desk were two clerks. He had hired them. But their real job was bookmaking. They were bookies, and he hired them because he was an addicted horse player, and he placed their bets with them.
And did other people at the Times also bet?
I became corrupted immediately. For the first time in my life, I placed a bet on the horses. All the reporters placed bets on the horses. I was at the Times one week. I was placing bets on horses, and I was drinking in the saloons with the reporters. I had just turned 20, and my father, I didn't even tell my mother about this. My father, who I would joke around with, he said, "You know, you must watch your step, Arthur."
Well, there was also, you mentioned the drinking. People were drinking beer openly in the newsroom.
Yes.
And you say there was a popular saying in those days, "Liquor is the curse of the Herald Tribune, but sex is the bane of the Times." So were there many inter-office romances going on as well?
I for my friends, I changed that saying. I said, "Sex and liquor were the bane of the times, because there was open drinking of beer, as you said, but there were also bottles of liquors hidden in locker rooms and in desks, and reporters would take a swig once in a while. Also, there was sex. Yes, there was. There were inter-office affairs. There were affairs with chorus girls. The newspaper men liked the chorus girls at the Latin Quarter and the Copacabana, and they would be dating
forgive me for following up with this question. Didn't you meet your wife at the New York Times?
She was an 18-year-old copy girl. I saw her cross the room, the city room, and I think I fell in love just at that moment. She was very pretty, and I soon discovered when I talked to her she was also witty. And when I found out, because I was Broadway stage struck, when I found out she was the stepdaughter of one of my favorite playwrights, S.N. Berman, I was absolutely mesmerized. And then I found out a couple of days later, because I was having I always wanted to talk to her, that she was the niece of Yasha Heifetz. Her mother was Yasha Heifetz's sister. So here was this provincial kid from the Bronx, introduced to gambling and drinking and everything else, but suddenly this world of music and this world of theater opened up to me through her relatives.
Is that how your son wound up in the music business? He now is the head of Sony Classics, isn't he? But he used to be Vladimir Horowitz's manager.
Yes, he grew up with a music with an he was an usher at the Met when he was in high school. He was an office boy for Sol Yurok. And then gradually he worked his way up to the Boston Symphony. I think he was deputy manager of the Boston Symphony and then eventually managing Horowitz and now Sony. I'll tell you a very funny story, actually.
You have to tell me after the break, unfortunately, because we have to go to a little break now. My guest is Arthur Gelb. His memoir, City Room, is a Marianne Wood book published by G.P. Putnam Sons. And this is WNYC. Stay with us. We're back with Arthur Gelb here on WNYC 93.9 AM 820. We're online at WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. The book in question is a memoir called City Room, which is published by Merriam Wood Putnam, Merriam Wood being the imprint here. You have written a number of books in the past and a few in collaboration, at least one in collaboration with your wife, because I remember you came here to talk about it. Same wife?
Same wife, a wife since 1946.
Wow, that's a successful marriage. So you're going to tell us a story about Vladimir Horowitz.
Yeah, my wife was Yasha Heifetz's niece, and Yasha Heifetz's father was a violinist in the Vilna Orchestra in Russia, and he discovered his infant son's genius when he was just in the crib by playing a happy song. Yasha would react happily, a sad song. Yasha would react sadly. So he was looking for another Yasha Heifetz, and when my son was born, which was Grandpa Heifetz's great-grandchild, he came to the house with a tuning fork and to see whether there was another genius here. He was very disappointed because his grandchildren didn't have that genius, so he tested my son. He didn't get the reaction he wanted, and it was devastating to watch his face as he realized there was not another Yasha Heifetz.
Are there born reporters, do you think?
Yes, I think there are. I think there are reporters who are people who have such curiosity, such innate curiosity, and have and who are naturals in terms of they have poetry in their souls, that they don't even need a formal education. They could write beautifully without any education, as long as they're well read.
Well, but that's the way it used to be. Today, it's hard to imagine someone getting a good job at the New York Times without a J school background. You went to college. I bet you there weren't even journalism classes then.
There school journalism was there, but very few of the reporters. And in fact, in my day, I didn't know anyone who went to journalism school. And some of the editors discouraged young reporters who wanted to take classes in journalism.
Do you think it would be possible today for someone like you, without a college degree, to start at the bottom of the New York Times and then work his way up to managing editor?
Impossible. You have to have at least one college degree. Some of the reporters have two. They're specialists in their fields, and it would be almost impossible to come to the Times without a college degree today.
You write about Abe Rosenthal, whom you describe as a wonderful reporter. The two of you were really close. You became known as Abe and Arthur, didn't you?
Yes, that's true. We knew each other when we were very young together on the paper, and he took a different direction. He became a foreign correspondent. I went into the drama department. Brooks Atkinson asked me to be his deputy. So I became a reporter and critic in the great drama department of the Times. Under Brooks. And then when Abe Rosenthal came back to be Metropolitan editor, he asked me if I would join him. I didn't want to, because I wanted to. I loved doing what I was doing, but the managing editor, Turner Catledge, persuaded me to do that.
Now, you say that Abe was able to write the entire story in his head and then just type it up.
Yeah, he was brilliant.
That was unusual, wasn't it?
Very unusual.
But he's also often the target of the Times' harshest critics because of what seems to have been, in some people's mind, a tendency toward advocacy journalism. Some will never forgive him for hiring Shirley Christian and running all of that stuff about the Bulgarian plot against the Pope. Raymond Bonner was fired for writing a story that turned out to be very accurate, a report of a massacre in El Salvador. And it was all because there were complaints that it was the communist stuff, and Abe immediately responded.
Abe also was responsible for getting the Pentagon Papers into the paper, which brought the Vietnam War to a much quicker close.
Was he responsible for the Times being so far behind the Washington Post and in covering the Watergate story?
No, I think that was the Washington Bureau at the time. I think that almost gave him a heart attack. But let me say something. Newspapering, I say this to all young people, is not a perfect craft. We make mistakes. We try to rectify them when we realize we've made them. Mistakes have been made from the very beginning. The coverage of the Holocaust, the way we covered it, was a mistake.
Now there's a whole problem with the coverage of the Stalin.
That's right. The coverage of Stalin. The way we succumbed not only the New York Times, but papers throughout the country and radio and television to McCarthy. That was one of the greatest mistakes of all time. There was such fear in the newspaper and television radio world about this menace who was scaring the hell out of everyone. That was a horrible mistake.
Well, how did that affect you? You were at the Times during the McCarthy years.
It certainly did affect me.
Did you censor yourself at times?
Brooks Atkinson sent me – never. Brooks Atkinson sent me out to do a review. I reviewed a play off-Broadway by Alice Childress, and it was called Trouble in Mind. I did not know that, wouldn't have mattered, but I did not know that Alice Childress was on some red baiting list. I gave the play a rave review. The next thing I knew, one of the red baiting newspapers, newsletters, attacked me of being a possible communist. I was under terrible pressure because if you were a newspaper person who was thought to be a left, you would be called down before a Senate investigating committee. Several of my friends were called down. I told Brooks Atkinson privately, I said I would never make a public statement about it under any circumstances, that I wasn't a communist. So he said, you didn't have to tell me that, but now that you did, I'm going to he was furious. He said, if anything happens to you, I leave this paper with you. And that's how serious the situation was. That was a big mistake.
You had to learn the newspaper business really on the fly, didn't you? But there was mentoring, people like Brooks Atkinson. Who was your first mentor?
I had several mentors, but the most interesting mentor I ever had was William L. Lawrence, who was the most illustrious science writer in the world. And he disappeared one day. I used to go to his desk every day. He disappeared one day, and no one knew what happened to him. The managing editor was evasive when the reporters asked him. And we didn't find out until August 5th, 1945, that his byline where he had been, because his byline, released on every story by the War Department, appeared on those stories. And we found out later that General Groves, Leslie Groves, who headed the Manhattan Project, which developed the bomb, came to the Times, asked to borrow Lawrence without telling the Times what the mission was. And he, the next day, Lawrence appeared at Oak Ridge, Tennessee, and his job was to write the history of the atom bomb and write the stories about the bomb when they were dropped.
Hmm. And then he returned to the Times after that was over.
He returned to the Times. He was under the command of the War Department while he did this. Then he returned to the Times, and the greatest story I ever wrote. I would not have been able to write it had it not been for him, because I had discovered that a anti-tuberculosis drug had been developed at a time when tuberculosis was the number one disease. It was a great scoop, and the city editor would not let me write it because he thought I didn't have the weight to go with that story, because stories lead said, but I wrote, that TB hospitals and sanatoriums would be closed down all over the world within a few years as a result of this drug. Lawrence was called in to write the story. He said, not on your life. This is Arthur Gelb's story, and how can I take that away from him? And I will check it with my own sources, which he did. He found that it was accurate. And if it had been another reporter, maybe that story would have been taken away from me. And, of course, it was on the top of page one. It was a great scoop.
With a byline.
With my byline. It was a fantastic scoop, and the story ran for months and months and months.
My guest is Arthur Gelb. His book, his latest, is City Room, published by Putnam and the Marion Wood imprint. This is WNYC 93.9 AM 820. We're online at WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. So it wasn't enough to have already had a byline. I'm sure you had printed other stories. It was
took me 2 years to get a byline in those days. Now you get a byline the first day.
Well, also, you were there during a momentous time. You were hired just a few weeks before D-Day?
Yes, it was one week.
So you were there during momentous times. In fact,
yes.
Your tenure at the Times was during momentous times.
Yes, absolutely.
Was there a feeling that there was something incredible going on? In 1968, for example, did everybody think, oh, my God, this is an incredible year?
Well, you,
or was it all the same? It's just writing stories every day.
I think it happened. It started slowly, but the 60s suddenly grew on us. We couldn't believe every single day there was a momentous story. We had the Vietnam War. We had the Civil Rights Movement. We had the Women's Liberation Movement. We couldn't have enough space on. We didn't have enough space on page one to play all these running stories.
And then there were breaking stories like Woody Allen coming along. You were the first person ever to interview him review him, weren't you?
Yes, I decided to start a new beat, and I went to the editors when I was in the drama department. I realized something special was happening in the country. We had a new vogue of intellectual stand-up comics led by Lenny Bruce, and I wanted to cover them. The Times felt that Lenny Bruce was too scatological. I insisted that I could handle it, and I went out and I wrote a long piece about Lenny Bruce. I became his very close friend, and in fact, once he called me and he said, listen, you have to come down. I have a new act, a new material, Basin Street East. I went to Basin Street East with Barbara, my wife, and we got there a little late. He was already on the stage. He saw me coming in, and he said, put the spotlight on that man. That's Arthur Gelb. He's brought sex to the New York Times. And then Woody Allen, everyone knew I was covering comics, so someone said, you got to go down and see this kid at the bitter end. He had never been written about. And I just popped in. He was funny as can be, and I wrote the first review of Woody Allen.
Also, one of the first critics to praise Barbara Streisand. But, you know, but Lenny Bruce was wrong. As you point out, sex was at the New York Times way before you arrived.
Yes, that's right.
Just weren't writing about
They weren't writing about it, right. That's exactly right.
And then you became an editor. Now, some people resist that. Charlene Hunter Gault, for example, they feel that their best work is as a reporter. Did you want to become an editor?
I didn't really want to become an editor. It was thrust upon me. I loved being a critic and I loved being a reporter, and I was asked to to take a chance being an editor. And I must say, once I became an editor, I loved it. I really did. I had a lot of ideas. I loved to throw out ideas. I really felt the front page, even though I didn't have a byline, I felt everything on the front page at Times was mine.
And then you were able to break some stories. Frank Serpico, for example.
Yes, we broke that story.
Why did he come to the Times?
Because he was such a man of integrity and so courageous. And the culture of the police department, not only in New York, but all over the country, was that an honest cop minded his own business, never blew the whistle. If you did, of course, you had to live under the threat of ending up in the East River face down. So Frank Serpico was the first one I knew in modern times who decided to do this. He went to City Hall. John Lindsay would not see him, believe it or not. I mean, John Lindsay was regarded as the white knight, but he would not see him. He went to the Commissioner of Investigations. He went to higher-ups in the police department. No one would see him. They started spreading the rumor that this was a crazy guy who was nutty. He went to see our police reporter, who had as much integrity and courage as Serpico, David Burnham. And Burnham took him to see me because he said he will not cooperate, he told Burnham, with the story unless he met Burnham's editor and got assurances from me that I would protect him and go along with the story.
And the Times in those days seemed to really be involved in investigative reports. It wasn't just the Serpico story. You had the nursing home scandals. You had the Pentagon Papers.
And the Daniel Burroughs case, we discovered that a man who was the leader of a major figure in the Nazi Party and in the Ku Klux Klan was a bar mitzvah Jew.
So why don't I get that feeling it's happening anymore at the Times? You're not there anymore. I can't blame you. You've been gone for 14 years or so. But still,
I'm still at the Times, though.
You are.
I'm the head of the New York Times College Scholarship Program.
But why has investigative reporting been put on the back burner, considering the fact that many people consider what Woodward and Bernstein did to be one of the great moments in American journalism? And the Times won so many awards for all of its investigations.
I think if we had some of our editors here now, they would argue with you. And I think the new managing editor especially, Jill Abramson, who I know has investigative reporting in her heart and in her bones. I know her quite well, and we just have to wait now and see what happens. She's just been in the job a short time, but I know what her thoughts are about investigative reporting, and they're very, very powerful.
We have very little time left. In the 70s, the New York Times went through some very bad times, and it was saved by the creation of those special sections, Science Tuesday, Weekend.
Yes.
And you played
Sports.
A major role in coming up with that, even
yes.
though people screamed their heads off at the time.
Yes. Well, the Times was in bad shape. It was 1975. The city had faced the worst fiscal crisis. The Tribune had closed down because of the big newspaper strike. And we were worried that we would go the way of the Herald Tribune. And there was great fear, so we started studying what to do. We came up with the idea that we would go from a two-section paper to a four-section paper. First two sections, hard news. The fourth section, business news, competing with the Wall Street Journal. Third section, a different section every day. And I was promoted to deputy managing editor to start the sections.
And that's good because it brings in a lot of advertising the Times might not have gotten otherwise?
Advertising comes second. Circulation is first. We brought in young readers with the same demographics as our older readers. They were college graduates. They read. A lot of them had professional jobs, but they weren't reading the Times. They were getting their news from television, Time, Newsweek. We brought them in to the Times, and that brought in advertising.
And then you created a whole bunch of celebrities, Pierre Frenet, for example,
yes.
Mimi Sheridan, Jane Brody, as a result of the creation of those sections.
Well, Jane Brody, I asked her to do a column called Personal Health, and she said, no, I'm not going to do that because I'm a science writer. And, you know, this is advice to, I don't want to do that kind of column. I said, Jane, this is a very important column. It's going to be written with your own. I'm not going to tell you how to write it, but we need this column for this section. It's one of the best things she's ever done.
Right, and It's really contributed to the prime of Jane Brody.
Yes.
forgive me for that. We can't get to Jason Blair and some of the other things, although the title of his book, according to at least what I've read in the paper, Burning Down My Master's House, My Life at the New York Times, does seem to be a bit excessive. And I wonder whether he's talking about the building on West 43rd Street or the new one that's proposed for 8th Avenue.
I think it's a shameful title.
But this one has a nice title, City Room. And my great thanks to Arthur Gelb for having been here to talk about his latest. Any more books in the works?
Yes. Oh. We have a new volume that we have outlined on Eugene O'Neill. We're doing a special documentary with Rick Burns on Eugene O'Neill for next spring. We're finishing up now.
You and Barbara, you were here with to Barbara. Talk about the Eugene O'Neill biography the last time. Putnam Publishers, City Room. Thank you so much, Arthur, for being with us again.
Thank you so much for having me here.